Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Well, thank you very much, Laura, and thank you, Carol. I'll be coming back at the end of my remarks to say a few words to Carol and to the group. As we speak tonight, 2019, entering the third year of Donald Trump's presidency, we're in the 25th day of the government shutdown. At the State Department, which was deemed not essential in the shutdown, 42% of our employees are at home, and those who are working are not being paid. Abroad, about 26% are not coming in. And so, you know, as is much of the government right now, it's sort of listing to starboard in the water. There's a Chiefs of Mission Conference going on in D.C. right now from our 188 posts. So far in this administration, 23 new ambassadors have been officially approved by the Senate, which is a rather low number. Many posts are vacant. You know, one of our colleagues here, a board member of Global Minnesota, Ross Wilson, has been asked to go out to the Republic of Georgia, where I once served, to be chargé in the interim. We've lost his services here at Global Minnesota, but he is, as former ambassador to Turkey and Azerbaijan, he's a very solid candidate to be. But that is typical of what's happening around the world. So in addition to all the issues and trends I'll be talking about today, there is a basic issue of process right now of governance in our country, which we have to hope will be resolved soon. So this is the time of year when people look ahead. It's not just me, whether it's papers in Europe, whether it's the Eurasia Group, the International Crisis Group, Foreign Policy Magazine, all these entities have their predictions for the year. As I've looked over them this time, the issues that come out starkly are obviously U.S. and China, the Middle East and Iran, Yemen, cyber issues, which are becoming more important, as we have announced in this past year that we are going to take a more offensive approach towards cyber attacks. In other words, that we may be launching our own in the coming year. Also, a number of issues in Africa, key elections coming up in Nigeria. We read about how Congo has kind of an aborted election that's just happened now, South Sudan, Cameroon. So there are many, many, many crises around the world that we'll be reading about and looking at in the coming year. But in the short time I have today, I'm going to focus on a few key areas to the exclusion, unfortunately, of some other ones. And those are China, above all, because we've just gone through a fateful shift in our relationship with China in the past year. The rising power of our era, the way the U.S. and China figure out the relationship between us will be key to global peace and global prosperity going forward. I want to spend ample time describing all the dimensions of the changes and the misunderstandings that are happening today. Secondly, I'm going to be focusing on the Middle East, of course, and primarily on Iran. Paul Piller, who will be coming here to Global Minnesota, former very high-ranking CIA analyst, one of the most respected people in Washington, I would say, has recently done an analysis of how the U.S. domestic situation could very well lead to a conflict with Iran in the coming year. It's classic tail wagging the dog. And so I want to talk in some detail about what's happening on the Middle East issue. And then third, Laura alluded to the nationalism that is rising in the world today. I was in Europe around New Year's, and just sort of following the debate, the press over there, as they looked ahead to 2019, the words and sort of the themes that came out were things like Year of the Autocrat, the Year of the Autocrat, 2018, that was The Guardian. The coming apart of both some of our international institutions, also domestic. The collapse of mainstream parties. We're seeing that and not just in our own country, but also in many countries, as the in the situation that we're in today, parties on the fringes are rising. Stress test for democracy, that was the Spiegel magazine in Germany's way of summing things up. And the other sort of phrase of the year that they came up with was in German, for those of you who still speak German, the bedrohte Wir-Gefühl, the threatened feeling of us or we, the sense that we're all in this together. It's not just the U.S. that is having some of these tectonics going on. It's other countries as well. It's the West. So I'll spend some time talking about governance, democracy, what's happening to our countries right now in this current atmosphere, because, as I say, this is something that goes way beyond our borders. So I'll be talking about other issues as well, but those will be the primary focus. You know, I guess you could say, and I'll get to that photo everyone has been waiting for. You know, we're into the third year of Donald Trump. Each year has been somewhat different. You know, this is so fast moving that you can kind of characterize each year and see it distinct from the other ones. But in addition to the third year, we're into the second phase of Donald Trump. Because with the midterm elections and the Democratic control of the House, this is a whole new situation for our foreign policy as well as for our domestic situation. So let me kind of sketch out these 3 years of Trump and where we are now. I show this because the one sort of continuity among Trump's advisors has been his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. With all the changes that have gone on, Jared is there, and he is in a fascinating position because he never speaks. He has his fingers in many different things, but is somewhat out of the picture. Actually, for President Obama, our own Dennis McDonough had a somewhat similar role from Minnesota, chief of staff at the end. He was kind of in the background, but very, very important. Jared is that figure for Trump. In the first year of Donald Trump, you had a series of advisors who really came from the mainstream of what people affectionately call the blob, from the foreign policy establishment. Jim Mattis at Defense, Rex Tillerson at State, McMaster at the NSC. I think Tillerson has said in public meetings in the State Department that when he and Mattis and McMaster agreed on policy, they could often have a strong influence on the president. He didn't quite say adults in the room, but that was the upshot of what he said. In addition, of course, now that has changed. We now have Mike Pompeo having replaced Tillerson, a very different person, one who's harder edged on issues like Iran. There have been a number of articles coming out recently, based on his speech in Cairo the other week, in which he talked about his religious faith. Pointing out that both Pompeo and Pence appear to be adherents of the rapture, the idea that religious outlook is important to them. Nobody is alleging that this is helping to frame their view of the Middle East, but on the other hand, this is, and he, as I say, in Cairo, speaking to an Arab audience, he did very much stress his faith. And then more importantly, perhaps John Bolton, as the national security advisor, who is playing a very prominent role. Now, with the departure of Jim Mattis following the president's decision to remove troops quickly from Syria, the last real stabilizing factor, I think, has left the administration. And so we head into year three now not only a changed domestic situation, but a new constellation among his advisors. This could make this a most turbulent year, perhaps. On the economic side, year one of Donald Trump, was Gary Cohn, Secretary of Treasury, had a very important role then. In year one, Trump struck out a number of sort of rhetorical positions: bilateralism, America first, fair trade, not free trade. He pulled out of a number of symbolic agreements like the Paris Climate Agreement and such things. But the focus really in that first year was domestic. It was trying to undo Obamacare and, most important of all, the tax cuts, which finally took place at the end of his first year. $1.5 trillion in cuts. And Gary Cohen was instrumental. His departure really sort of adumbrated the second year of Donald Trump, in which the gloves to some extent came off on a number of issues, especially on tariffs. And here they are. These are the four horsemen of the tariff apocalypse. Steve Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, most importantly, Robert Lighthizer, who I think is the real brains behind what's happening now, and Peter Navarro, who is something of a cheerleader on these issues. Year two saw a coming together of policies, especially toward China, on trade, and I'll be describing those in detail, on tariffs, a new national security strategy, and a situation in which a number of issues now have been left hanging for this third year. You could say there's a number of cliffhangers out there, and I'll be describing those, because on China, you know, we have until March 1st to strike a trade agreement, or else heavy tariffs go into effect. Having pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, it remains to be seen what action we'll take finally on Iran. And this comes on top of course, things like Brexit, other sort of cliffhanger events that we'll be talking about going forward. So the third year is likely to be quite different. Now, what does all this mean if you take a step back? And I think Robert Kagan, who is a prominent neoconservative policy analyst, quite influential actually in both parties, summed it up pretty well a couple of months ago when he said, is the Donald Trump administration an aberration or is it a culmination? Is it something that is going to be like a passing squall, which when it's over, things will go back to normal, both parties will get back on track? Or does he represent deeper forces in American society? All these years after 9/11, with our economic inequalities that we have today, immigration as an issue, all these things that will continue to produce the kinds of policies that Donald Trump has represented. Kagan clearly comes down on the side of culmination. And he's a bit of a Cassandra figure. I think he's trying to warn everyone that America has got to play a central role. We cannot step back from our responsibilities. We should remain the indispensable nation at whatever cost. But he's obviously, he and others are deeply concerned now that that America is heading long-term in a different direction. And if you're an ally of the U.S., this is an important consideration. Do you wait this out, or do you begin to adjust more fundamentally to what's going on? And there are some signs that allies now are beginning to adjust, and I'll describe some of those as we go forward. So as I said, now the first area I really want to focus in on is China. Because there's been really a quantum shift that's gone on in the past year toward China, and it has a lot of causes and a lot of implications. It's exactly 40 years ago that that Jimmy Carter and Deng Xiaoping, in early 1979, signed the final reconciliation establishment of diplomatic relations between our two countries. It's amazing all that's happened in 40 years. And it's also 40 years since the opening of China under Deng Xiaoping. This is kind of a symbolic moment here, and it's kind of poignant that the relationship has taken this turn at that exact juncture. There have been three schools, I would argue, toward China in the U.S. since the opening. The first, represented by Robert Zoellick, former World Bank president, who coined the term responsible stakeholder, the idea that if we engage China, if we bring them into the World Trade Organization, they will become more like us, they will be vested in the global economy, and they'll become, yes, responsible stakeholders. A little bit the same outlook as someone like Tom Friedman, the world is flat, there's a certain ineluctable aspect to globalization where if you really enter into it, you're going to be transformed. Of course, part of the problem today is that people are realizing China's not changing that much for all of its wealth. And maybe the backlash is stronger because our expectations were too high and too unrealistic about how China might change. Zoellick has been writing articles very critical of what's happening now, saying it's a fool's game to try to contain China. It's too big, there's too much underway, our economies are too interlocked. So he still, I think, would advocate that position. The second approach happened under the Obama administration, in which the views of people like John Mearsheimer, other sort of realist scholars, were taken into account. The idea that China may be rising peacefully now, but we don't know what it'll be like once it's risen. It may emerge as a threat, and we need to start hedging now. We can't just wait until it's fully emerged. And Kurt Campbell, who was Assistant Secretary for Asia, very close to Hillary Clinton, if she had won, would have been in a very high position, was really the architect of a lot of that policy, known now as the pivot. And it included some military beefing up in Asia, raising the South China Sea issue very abruptly with the Chinese in 2010. The Chinese took this as a first step toward trying to blunt their rise. And so already under the Obama administration, we were into another phase with China. But the trade relationship went on unencumbered. And that's what's different now. Here's Peter Navarro. His promotion last year to a higher position kind of indicated what was coming. Death by China, one job lost at a time. The focus is on the effects of our trade relationship with China on our own economy, on jobs. And as Donald Trump says so many times, everyone's taking advantage of us. This has got to stop. There's strong sentiment that China has been taking advantage of us on things like intellectual property, forced technology transfer, subsidized industries, state industries in China. And that has been a negative for the US. It's ironic that Xi Jinping, when he first came in, 2013-2014, in his first summit with Obama, kind of warned that the relationship had to be carefully managed. He put at the top of his agenda for that summit Thucydides and the Peloponnesian Wars and the idea of a rising power and a status quo power and how historically that always ends in war. Graham Allison from Harvard came out with a book just a few months ago called Destined for War. He looked at 16 cases in which historically a power was rising, like Germany in the end of the 19th century, status quo power. 12 of the 16 ended in war. So the Chinese message was, we have to be very careful. History's against us, but it's in our hands. We need a new type of great power relationship. And it's, of course, it's going totally the other way right now, very tragically. And in China, Xi Jinping, as I say, responsible stakeholder, in many ways, he's tightening up. The anniversary of Karl Marx's birth was celebrated with great fanfare in China. In the sleepy Rhineland town of Trier, Germany, where Marx was born, people woke up to see this enormous statue of Karl Marx, which present from the people of China. The mayor of Trier didn't want it and tried to convince the federal government that that this should be returned to China, but that was determined that they should accept it. It would not go on the main town square, as the Chinese had hoped. Rather, you can see this looks like the back of a building somewhere. But yes, the party is back. When you talk to Chinese officials and scholars, in the last couple of years, the party is much more present under Xi Jinping than it had been before. Party cadres are more active in the workplace, in the universities. There's a much stronger feeling that one has to pay attention to the party line. And Xi Jinping's thought, as they call it, has been enshrined in the Constitution. Problems we have with China is their state-run industries. I'll get back to that in a minute, but the fact that they are, to some extent, subsidized. And it's a very telling statistic, and one that's not been lost on this administration, that in 2013, of the loans going to Chinese businesses, only 36% went to state enterprises, 57% went to private enterprises. By 2016, after 2 years of Xi, 83% of all loans were going to state enterprises, and just 11% to private. So if anything, there's been a strengthening or a greater focus on the state sector in the last couple of years in China. And of course, that's exactly what the US has begun to complain about. The other aspect of Xi's tenure so far is and I'm sure you've all read about this, I won't dwell on this, but the massive One Belt, One Road, New Silk Road, Belt and Road Initiative that was rolled out a couple of years ago. It is massive. It involves 70 countries with China at the center. They've created an Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and encouraging others to get involved, including us. And as you can see, the infrastructure is quite vast, three high-speed train lines across Eurasia, ports. And it actually links up with what the Chinese are doing in Africa. In fact, the Chinese have announced that Africa is officially part of the New Silk Road. So this, only a country run by engineers, and China is a country run by engineers, and this dates back way in Chinese history to the management of rivers in old China, are capable of this kind of long-term planning. And it's interesting that a lot of this was not really announced. They've just been doing it. And people have been figuring out how this all connects. So there are a lot of problems with this. We are opposed to this. We don't want China setting the agenda this way for global commerce, global infrastructure. First, we tried to get all of our allies to refrain from joining in. Most of them have by now. But we're pointing out that there's a debt trap involved, that if you get into this, you could end up owing China money. Countries like Sri Lanka, Malaysia, have found themselves kind of boxed in by the debts that they've incurred to China. So we are continuously warning our allies and our friends to step back from this. But it's going forward. Trump has announced his own infrastructure program now, but it's only $65 million. It's very, very small and rather notional at this point. The other thing that's making Washington, in addition to these other turns of events, beneath all of the discord about trade, about deficits, about jobs, talk of tariffs, there is a fundamental problem, and that is Washington has the sense that China is about to move ahead in tech. There used to be the thought that time was on our side. Now there's a thought that maybe time is on China's side, and that they have been, using our technology, sending their students here, learning as you would expect them to do, going back and applying their knowledge, and that this somehow is emerging as a threat. I think, you can debate whether that is true, whether that really is a threat. China is not spending anywhere near what we do militarily, but a lot of defense going forward will depend on AI, on quantum physics, on that sort of thing. So Washington is deeply concerned, and it's one reason why it may be hard to resolve the difficulties right now. Here you can see, first of all, I got these backwards, GDP rates, military spending, and then most importantly, R&D spending. China's R&D spending has increased tenfold in the past 10 years, and they're focusing on key sectors. Xi Jinping has announced Made in China 2025, where China wants to be the global leader in key areas of tech, Whether they'll pull it off or not, it is a declared policy. Washington is responding to this. And if you look at the blogosphere in China, there are voices saying, you know, why doesn't Xi Jinping follow Deng Xiaoping's admonition to rise quietly, hide our strengths, let's just, you know, as opposed to declaring like this. People wish he'd keep his mouth shut, I think, is the bottom line. But Washington is responding, and you can see China coming up now in science. They're not just copying. They may be at a takeoff point in tech. Now, what is most striking about China, and there are many, many articles about this. The MIT Technology Review had one recently, citing the term translational technology. Translational technology. China is applying the technology rapidly as it develops in a wide range of areas. They're not waiting. And so you're beginning to see China moving ahead in a number of areas. Now, this is the U-2, which landed on the dark side of the moon some weeks ago, Chinese venture. This is a 500-meter aperture spherical telescope, which was opened in 2016. It's two times the size of the next largest telescope, way out in Guizhou province in China. Now, this has a rather interesting gestation because it really is a direct result of the most popular novel in China of recent years, and that is The Three-Body Problem, which is part of a trilogy. In a nutshell, the young woman, a young scientist, as a small girl, sees her parents harassed during the Cultural Revolution, both professors, her father actually killed by his own students. And she concludes, she goes way into herself and concludes that the human race does not deserve to exist. And as fate would have it, she becomes part of the team that makes first contact with something so alien as it approaches Earth that it communicates only through virtual reality games. It's a fascinating novel. It was Obama's favorite novel in his last year as president. In fact, the later volumes have sort of recommendations from him. The second volume is called Dark Forest, i.e., the universe is not a friendly place. It's a dark forest from which something will emerge. So China wants to be the first to make first contact. And I think that one reason they went so fast on this issue was just the impetus from this novel, the fact that so many Chinese were reading it and thinking about it. This is He Jianke, who, once again, translational science. You develop genomics and you apply it. You don't wait. Well, as you probably saw, two young girls, baby girls, were born that had been genetically modified. The technology exists to do this. It's against the law in the West to do this, to enhance human beings. I mean, this is a whole moral debate we'll be having going forward. But China has leapt ahead. I mean, this gentleman has been criticized in China as well for taking this step. But it's indicative of how fast some of this is being applied. Another area where China is ahead is in the quantum race. The China Electronic Technology Corporation, which is the largest defense electronics corporation in China, unveiled a new prototype of quantum detection that can detect stealth aircraft in flight. Now, here's an example of major military results from Chinese technology. You know, we have relied heavily on stealth technology in recent decades, and it's a big change if China now has the technology that can see through to this. We've talked previously about China's new initiatives on governance, the social credit system, where cameras, facial recognition cameras are being installed all over China with the intent of monitoring the population. People will get credit reports, social credit reports with rewards and punishments that will follow. This is the kind of shift that Washington says, wait a minute, they're really not becoming like us. If anything, they're going the other way. And, you know, China, you know, is has its own traditions. It's a very deep and ancient civilization. It has its own framework for what it does. And in China, and in Chinese tradition, harmony is maybe the most important concept. It implies social cohesion, social harmony. Not that the individual isn't important, but that's not the starting point. So what seems very alien to us, when I talk to my Chinese students about this, they say, well, if it prevents crime and if it makes for a more orderly society, why not? At intersections in China today, you can see here people waiting to cross the street. There are these panels. If you jaywalk, there's a guy, you see his face. They caught him in mid jaywalking. And within 3 seconds, his face and his information was on that screen. Embarrassing enough, but it means also that the government has registered that he did that, and it's going into your social credit score. This is translational technology. It's being implemented immediately as it is coming out. Chinese police today wear sunglasses. A New York Times reporter succeeded in convincing one of them to lend the lenses for a few minutes, and when he looked at a person across the way, that person's face and data came up on the inside of the lens. This exists, this already exists, and is being used in China. It's something that may be used here, who knows? I was talking with someone recently who's in industry who said that there's more and more monitoring of employees at corporations, companies. It's not just truck drivers. So this kind of monitoring is going on in the private sector in the US already, not more generally. So with all these changes and with the election of Donald Trump and the first steps he took to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, signaling that we maybe would be less involved in the global economy, for one thing, and in Asia, the Chinese stole a march on us in January 27th. 2017, Xi Jinping went to the World Economic Forum, which will take place under the snow mountains this year again. It looks like Donald Trump will not go this year because of the shutdown. He was going to meet with the Chinese there, but this may not happen. Anyway, Xi Jinping made it very clear that China's in the game. China's for the climate agreement. China is for free trade. China can be relied upon. And definite soft power accretion by China. So Donald Trump went the next year to make up for this and gave a very strong speech in which he said, America first, fair trade. We are interested in fair trade, not free trade. And then he said something very elusive that people had a hard time figuring out. He said the United States will no longer accept or tolerate state-run economies, which is kind of a broad brush thing to say. A lot of our allies, in some ways Japan and even Korea employed some of the same tactics as they rose and became more powerful as China has. They protected their economy too and still do in many regards and with a greater state role than we're used to. But it's clear that this is aimed at countries that we disagree with who have systems like this. So, that was the first shot across the bow for what then became the new policy on China. A month later, James Mattis, then still Secretary of Defense, gave a major speech outlining the new national security strategy of the United States, which marked an abrupt shift in our approach to China. The basic idea being the threat is no longer terrorism, which is still a problem, but not the main threat. It is revisionist states like China and Russia who are trying to undo the international liberal order that we created and that are acting against US interests, and we must stand up to this new threat. So China is suddenly singled out as a primary threat to the United States. Mattis lamented that the US military capacity had dwindled in recent decades, largely because of the post 9/11 military involvements. He said we're falling behind in all areas. So he announced a massive increase in defense spending in the coming years, about $3.7 trillion. Our defense budget is heading up over $750 million toward $8 trillion. The idea being to counter China and Russia in traditional but also in the new technologies, cyber, AI, all these things. When you look at it, on the heels of a $1.5 trillion tax cut, and now this massive defense spending, and now the Democrats are in talking infrastructure spending and raising the deficit ceiling, the debt ceiling, you start to wonder whether an issue may be emerging on our debt and how we're going to fund these very ambitious programs. Of course, the other then piece that was put in place was the announcement of tariffs, not just on China, but we're threatening the Europeans and the Japanese with 25% tariffs on their cars if deals aren't struck this year, trade deals with them. And obviously, China is the main focus. They export about over $500 billion worth of goods to us each year. We're putting tariffs on about $250 billion of that, about half, at 10%. If the Chinese don't agree with our demands by March 1st, it'll be 25% on everything. And with the threat of adding them to the other $250 billion. So China is negotiating. They're trying to find a way around this. It looks like Xi Jinping is willing to make some compromises on intellectual property, tech transfer, and investment, opening up the economy to some extent. But, and here I come back to Trump's statement at Davos, it's not just those issues. If you look at the new NAFTA, which we pretty much forced on the Mexicans and the Canadians late last year, and here they are signing it. There was a provision in that agreement, Article 32, Section 10, regarding non-market countries. And it basically says that any country that enters into a free trade agreement with a non-market country shall allow the other parties to terminate the agreement within 6 months. Now, it looks like we're going to insist on a similar clause with the Europeans and with the Japanese. In other words, trying to squeeze China back out of the global economy. There was a firestorm in Canada about 10 days after this was signed. Nobody had realized that this was in there. And now there's all kinds of articles, did we give up our national sovereignty? People are critical of Justin Trudeau for having gone along with this. Whether this will be enforced is hard to say, but the intent is quite clear. And that raises then the question, are we going to insist that China make concessions that would amount to a restructuring of the way it organizes its domestic economy? Are we going to insist that they stop subsidizing state enterprises? If so, it'll be very difficult to reach an agreement with China, because that would cause tremendous domestic disruption, unemployment in China, and Xi Jinping actually is going the other direction right now, especially as China now is experiencing a slowdown that we've all been reading about. So I think a lot of people think that there will be a symbolic agreement. Both sides are hurting. The stock market is down. Donald Trump doesn't like that. He may come to some kind of a limited deal with China that doesn't get into this other aspect, but we'll see. I know his hardline advisors are urging him to stay firm and to impose the tariffs if China doesn't change the way it organizes itself. As Donald Trump says, tariff wars are easy to win. It's probably easier when you don't export as much as they do. Interestingly enough, Chinese exports to the U.S. increased by 17% last year, in spite of all the tariff problems, partly because Chinese demand was down and they were buying fewer projects. Now, the other big sort of symbolic aspect of this trade dispute and tech dispute was the arrest of the CFO of and daughter of the founder of Huawei, which if you're in Asia, I was in Asia in December, Huawei is everywhere. It's emerging as a major player competing with Google, with a lot of our large corporations. They're doing very well. And so the Canadian arrest of the daughter of the founder is still a big issue. China's not responded against us. They're retaliating against Canada. They just sentenced a Canadian citizen to death for drug trafficking, and obviously this is the beginning of some kind of an exchange, they hope. And so The negotiations will continue at the end of this month with Robert Lighthizer and Liu He, who is the Vice Premier of China, trying to reach an agreement. As I say, there's a chance that they will get some kind of a deal, just because I think Donald Trump doesn't like the disruption he's seeing right now in our own economy. More broadly, you know, China, like Russia, is attempting to create strategic depth in its own region. I think that that really defines what those two countries are about right now. The way China is acting in Ukraine and toward Europe, they feel that they've been encroached upon from their point of view. They're trying to push back, create strategic depth. And I think that China has the same feeling in what they call the first island chain, which includes the South China Sea and obviously Taiwan, which is a more serious issue than people realize. If we're going to come to blows with China, it's most likely to be over Taiwan, because we're committed to defending Taiwan, and China's announced that it will move against Taiwan if they declare independence. So I just say a couple words about the situation in Taiwan in the context of this deterioration of the relationship. Tsai Ing-wen, who is in the Democratic Progressive Party, which won a couple of years, you know, she's the one who had the phone call with Trump when he was first elected, much to the chagrin of the Chinese. She is theoretically for independence, as is a new party called the New Power Party. But she has suffered stinging defeats in local elections recently, and it is very possible that the old Kuomintang party, which is against independence, may come back into power. So the situation may be easing a bit. The Chinese, as you can see, here's the way people feel about independence on Taiwan, and the ones who want to go straight for independence are in a clear minority in Taiwan today. So I think there's every reason to hope that this will stay stable in spite of all the other problems. North Korea, of course, is another issue. We very much look to China to help on that. I think the basic misunderstanding on North Korea that's at the heart of what's going on, the U.S. is talking about denuclearization as a prerequisite for normalizing relations with Pyongyang. With South Korea, just like China and North Korea, consider peace as the prerequisite for denuclearization, not the other way around, not denuclearization as a prerequisite for peace. And the fact that South Korea and North Korea are coming together more and more with visits kind of creates a fait accompli for Trump in a way that stabilizes the situation to some extent. I'm trying to find positive, optimistic things that are going on. And having done that, now let's turn to the Middle East. Are we pulling out of Syria? Are we pulling out of Afghanistan? How fast? You know, the areas of control, you can see what is controlled by the Islamic State at this point. You can see the Kurdish area of Syria, and they've been our allies against ISIS. As we say we're pulling out, you know, Donald Trump basically called Erdogan and said, look, you take care of the situation, we're out of here, we leave it to you. And even said, well, if Iran is still there, so what? Which, that was too much for many people, including John Bolton, and I think our Israeli friends. And so this has been walked back. We're at loggerheads with the Turks again about what to do. Iraq, similarly, you've got the Kurdish issue there. The Kurds are very divided. The Iraqi Kurds and the Syrian Kurds are not on the same wavelength at all. It's a very kind of clannish situation. And then Afghanistan, are we pulling back? And if so, how fast? And are we leaving it to the Taliban? All this is up in the air. I think the basic problem is that the American people have less stomach for this kind of involvement. I think Trump sensed that even during the campaign. I think he got votes on that basis, criticizing everyone for the Iraq invasion. I think that the policy establishment realizes there are limits to what we can do. Frankly, 2,000 troops in Syria is largely symbolic when you think about it. That's not what's going to tip the balance against Iran and Russia there. So Mike Pompeo laid out the U.S. position just a few days ago in Cairo, as I mentioned. And his focus, as always, was on Iran. And the need to sanction Iran, first of all, and ideally to bring about, I guess, what you would call an implosion of the regime, if possible. The sanctions are biting. They're hurting Iran. Donald Trump, right when he came into office, clearly reached out to Saudi Arabia. The first country he visited was Saudi Arabia. First time a president has done that. Usually it's the Europeans or Canada or Mexico. And he's solidified his relationship with Israel. We moved our embassy to Jerusalem. And so we are clearly now working with the Saudis and the Israelis. Where there's division, you know, the Saudis and the Israelis both are concerned about Iran and would like to do something about Iran. And the Saudis have mobilized other Sunni countries, but there's a deep division within the Sunni world between the Turks and the Saudis over the issue primarily of the Muslim Brotherhood. That's the key sticking point. For Erdogan, the Muslim Brotherhood is the future of the Middle East. It can be a Muslim democratic, democratically elected movement, as in Egypt with Morsi when he was elected, whereas the Saudis see this as a mortal threat. They are threatened by elected Muslim governments because that's not their model. It is delegitimizing for them to have a democratic Muslim trend. So that's the reason that Erdogan was more than willing to milk everything he could out of the tragic assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. A terrible event. I don't think anybody in Washington doubts that Mohammed bin Salman was involved. And we're trying to maintain a close alliance with the Saudis in spite of this very inconvenient truth. And I don't think the Saudis realized how much the Turks had in place to monitor their consulate in Istanbul. That came as a surprise to them. So Turkey is not on board for what may be coming on Iran. And in fact, a Turkish scholar who was in town a couple of weeks ago said that really Turkey and Iran have had a basically pragmatic relationship going back centuries, going back to the Ottoman period and to the Persian Empire, where they basically agree to respect each other, not get aggressive with each other. And so therefore, Turkey will not be mobilized in what may be coming. Karen Elliott House, the former publisher of the Wall Street Journal and a real expert on Saudi Arabia, predicted in an article about a week ago that there will be an official meeting between Mohammed bin Salman and Netanyahu in the very near future. The cooperation has been going on under the table for a long time, including military and intelligence cooperation. The idea is that with the very feeble reaction to moving the U.S. embassy. And by the way, Brazil is about to move their embassy also to Jerusalem under Bolsonaro, the next really big country to do so. The idea is that this can be tolerated, that public opinion won't react to an overt meeting. We'll see if that actually happens. But as the Turks basically are trying to work with Iran, the Russians, the Europeans, the Chinese, all the signatories of the Iran nuclear deal are still abiding to the deal and are trying to preserve it. There is a possibility, and Netanyahu has called early elections. He's under domestic pressure at home over various scandals, just like Trump. They're kind of in a parallel position. And there are increasing rumors that once that election is over, Netanyahu may go after Hezbollah in Lebanon. Now, Hezbollah is an ally of Iran, and it's thought that with any attack on Iran, one of the first things that would happen would be a volley of thousands of missiles from Hezbollah in Lebanon into Israel. That would be one of the main sort of counteractions to what might happen. And that therefore, to defuse that threat first, before then taking on Iran, would make sense. So we'll see. If that two-step scenario is in the offing, and many people are beginning to conclude it may be, then the first sign will be in the late spring, maybe early summer, some kind of action by Israel toward toward Hezbollah. Israel is already stepping up its strikes in Syria as we pull out, going after Iranian assets directly there as well. It's ironic, you know, the summit between Putin and Trump had as one of its main points coordination on Iran. Both the Saudis and the Israelis would like to get Putin away from Iran, kind of, you know, find a way to either buy him off or convince him. So, you know, the old Saudi king visited Putin in the past year. Putin has very close relations with Israel. And that was one of Trump's messages, trying to convince Putin. So the part of the hidden substance of that meeting may have to do with Iran. Now, this brings us to Europe, because the Europeans are trying to stand up for the nuclear deal. And this is becoming one of the many points of disagreement between our allies in Europe and the United States. These points are much more important than any rhetorical flourishes of should we stay in NATO, if you don't spend 2%, we won't defend you. These are real issues, and one of them is John Bolton has threatened any country, any company that deals with Iran against our sanctions, we will impose secondary sanctions on them. And that includes the Europeans. And he has especially warned the Europeans not to get involved. Europe, for its part, is saying it's in our national interest to preserve the deal. They even passed a law theoretically making it illegal for European companies to go along with our sanctions. I don't think that's going to be enforced, but it's on the books. And they've set up a reserve fund to help companies in that situation. So this could be a big point. If we really do move toward a confrontation with Iran in the coming year, we will not have our European allies on board this time. This is Federica Mogherini, the foreign minister of the EU, with Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, and the contacts are very active between the EU and Iran. Now, in the midst of all this, Jean-Claude Juncker, the head of the European Commission, gave his State of the Union address late last year, and said, look, and this gets into the long-term aspects, Europe must adjust to the new situation. We must move away from the dollar. We must become more independent. He even talked about possibly setting up a new electronic payment system like SWIFT. This is all notional, but it shows that our use of sanctions and our use of secondary sanctions could run the risk of causing people to pull away from the very things that give us the leverage, that is the central role of the dollar, for one thing. Now, is there an alternative currency to the dollar? No. But there are already signs that regionally countries are pooling, coming up with pooling arrangements, Russia and China, for example, and there are other examples of this, to try to get away from the dollar. So we may be speeding up something that would have been happening anyway. It isn't just China with a deadline, March 2nd. We agreed to give more time to negotiating with the Europeans. Those negotiations will start. There are some big issues. The Europeans do not want to budge on agriculture. We want them to open up their agricultural sector to us. They have highly protected agriculture in Europe, and they have said they will not change their position on that. So, you know, who knows? Theoretically, if things don't go through, there'll be 25% tariffs on European cars. And the Germans are obviously quite worried about this. The Germans are also, and the Europeans, are quite involved in the new Silk Road. And you can see some of the, I spent some time in Prague, and the Chinese are building in Piraeus, going up toward Germany. A lot of European companies are involved. The Europeans don't want their intellectual property stolen. They're taking certain measures, but they're not on board for a full-scale trade war with China. That's another point of disagreement. Very importantly, we pulled out of the Intermediate Nuclear Range Forces Treaty, INF, a few months ago. It was signed in 1987. This is something that is essential to the Europeans because the deployments that may ensue will be in Europe. And that agreement was signed originally to get intermediate forces out of Europe. So there's been a very strong negative reaction from our European allies to this. As I say, this is more important than anything Trump says. This is real policy here we're talking about now. This is John Bolton in Russia informing Putin. Putin's reaction, of course, has been quite negative. He's warning of a new arms race, saying that Russia will counter-deploy if this treaty goes by the boards. You can see the range of this puts most of Europe right in the crosshairs, and something the Europeans want to avoid. Ukraine is festering. The skirmish at the Straits of Kerch toward the Sea of Azov. You can see that the Russian-supported area there in Crimea, they really have kind of cut off that whole coast of Ukraine, another form of pressure. So Ukraine will have elections this year, and we'll see how that goes. Oops. And Putin has announced new types of weapons that Russia's developing, claiming they can't be detected. When he presented this last spring, they showed a film of a missile taking off from Russia and basically landing on Mar-a-Lago. Very interesting. I mean, it clearly was heading to southern Florida, and you could imagine what they were trying to show. And the Russians and the Chinese now have begun joint exercises. We are basically pushing Russia and China together at the present time, more than would be the case. Now, in Europe, I'm going to rush right through to the end here. I mentioned the collapse of parties in the center, and people thought that Emmanuel Macron represented a new force. He seemed to be bringing together the center in a new coalition, you know, going beyond the old parties. It's turned out to be a chimera, frankly. Sort of rural-urban divide that people have talked about has really come out full force as the protesters against his economic plans have come out, the Gilets Jaunes. It's not over yet. He's on a speaking tour around France trying to calm things. But France, like Germany, is weakened now. This is Angela Merkel. She is stepping down as chancellor. Her successor is a woman who has a name so unpronounceable. It's Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer. Everyone just calls her AKK. They're on the left. She'll be the new head of the party there. And of course, the histrionics in Britain are only increasing. In December, the cameras picked up Jeremy Corbyn saying, "Oh, that stupid woman," which of course was a very offensive thing to say. And he said, "No, I said those stupid people." So everyone did these intense analyses of the way his lips moved, and he basically said, "Stupid woman." But anyway, as you know, she suffered the greatest defeat in the last 100 years in a British parliamentary vote yesterday, 432 to 202 for her Brexit plan. Here are the MPs lining up to vote. They vote out in the hallway, not on the floor, in the British Parliament. There they are. And what's going to happen? Nobody knows. I heard Ed Luce from the Financial Times on the radio today, and he said, "Nope, I don't know. Nobody knows what's going to happen." I think one thing is pretty sure: the deadline of March 29 at 11 o'clock under Article 50 is likely to be postponed. I think that's a pretty fair prediction. I was told in Britain in December that in order to have a new referendum, you'd have to have a new national election. There'd have to be preceded by an election in which this was an issue, and then you could have a referendum. Would there be time then to call an election in which this was on the agenda? So we'll see. I can't imagine the pragmatic British just tumbling out of the EU. It would just be too disruptive. It's not, in my view, in their character, but then who knows? Now, this brings us to democracy. The Eurasia Group, Ian Bremmer and company, I'm allowed to use this. I asked them about it. One of their threats for the coming year was the bad seeds, they called it. Basically, all the autocrats that are out and about, and interesting, they included Trump and Netanyahu and obviously Bolsonaro, Salvini, the deputy or the interior minister of Italy. But that, you know, these forces, these groups are increasingly strong. The Freedom House, in its report on democracy for this past year, said it was a rough year. the roughest in a good while as democracy came under question in many countries. Kishore Mahbubani of Lee Kuan Yew University in Singapore has a book out called Has the West Lost It? And he makes a distinction in his view between the US and Europe. He says the driver of radicalism and right-wing nationalist forces in Europe is immigration. These countries are not used to this. But in the US, he said, it's inequality, it's plutocracy. That those issues are grating on the lower and middle class and causing them to react against immigration, which would not happen if the economy were more equal and in better shape. That's his view. There'll be a watershed in May, the European parliamentary elections. The radical parties of left and right are likely to do quite well. Good old Steve Bannon is over there, has been for the past 6 months, advising all the right-wing parties of Europe on how to create a tsunami for this election. There he is with Matteo Salvini. The US ambassador in Germany is also somewhat involved in this. Now, you know, we've had more radical, I mean, Bolsonaro in Brazil, you know, is continuing this, but there are signs that maybe, you know, democracy is still alive and well. I think our own state has shown that, and I think the midterm elections have shown that. And there have been articles saying maybe this populism is starting to abate somewhat. I think it's a function of terrorist attacks and immigration flows, but still. And of course, even Narendra Modi now is somewhat weakened and may not win the next election in India. And of course, we have López Obrador in Mexico, a new face of change, and what this will portend, we don't know. Now, democracy. I have two things to say. Number one, Neil Postman pointed this out back in the 80s, that there was a fundamental difference between George Orwell in 1984 and Aldous Huxley in Brave New World about what the threat was to democracies. For Orwell, it was the fear that the truth would be concealed from us, Big Brother, be controlled. For Huxley, there was the fear that truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. There was a population too narcotized by undisguised trivialities to engage as responsible citizens. You know, I suppose every country is different, but when I try to get news on our TV, I feel drowned sometimes, I must say. The other threat to our democracy is a new technology that is emerging and is getting a lot of attention. Generative adversarial networks, GAN, also called deep fake. Now, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, has this as a top priority now to try to detect streaming video that by all accounts is real. It could be a video of Trump declaring war on Iran, for example. How do you know that it's not real? And so a lot of money is being spent trying to keep the detection ahead of the technology. This is going to be potentially a big disruptor because it won't just be governments that will be able to use deepfake. It'll be citizens and groups as well. And from what I'm reading, the experts are not sure that they can stay in front of this. They're very much not sure that they can do so. Last couple things, if you give me one more minute. Where's Tim? He usually comes up here and just drags me off the stage. But, you know, sustainability is obviously still so important. Population projections continue to head up between 11 and 12 billion by the end of the century. Yes, Africa, look at the growth that's still being projected. About 40% of humanity, theoretically, will be living in Africa. You can see the cohorts, and what's changing is because of the improvements in health, which is a wonderful thing, people are living longer. And so you get that aspect adding to the population too. You know, Nicholas Kristof, Steven Pinker have been writing that we're actually living in a pretty decent age where children are surviving longer. A lot of health statistics in the developing world are much better, and we shouldn't overlook these very positive developments for humanity. And I think that that's true. You know, this is the world's biggest countries by population in 2100. You can see many of them will be in Africa, at current trends, of course. And climate, there were three recent studies that came out One, our own U.S. government, 13 agencies, you probably saw that, a report that was very much at variance with the administration's position about the dire prospects for global warming, what it would do to the U.S. GDP, which could fall 10% or more, and agricultural yields falling. It really sounded the alarm. The UN in October, maybe trying to get our attention, said we have just 10 years to act. This is what the UN report said, that we're going to sail way above the 1.5 degree centigrade threshold by 2030 and building from there. And then finally, in the journal Science, the report you probably saw in the New York Times and elsewhere, that they concluded that the oceans are warming at a rate 40% higher than they had thought, compared to estimates 5 years ago. So these are all wake-up signs that we have to take seriously, that something must be done. And when I look at my students and the new generation, they get it. And it's just a matter of hoping that this will be. Now, last two things I promised. There are a couple poignant things this year. The passing of George H.W. Bush was widely noted. He was a fine man. I had a chance to be around him a bit during my career. He worked within institutions. He worked with the UN. The first Gulf War, we didn't pay a red cent for that because we were working with our allies on it. He is also somebody who, and maybe this was his generation, had a certain historical grounding. And I was privy to discussions in, at the end of the Cold War in which the contrast between the end of World War I and the end of World War II was evoked in discussions. A punitive peace in World War I, a more inclusive peace by us in World War II. And I think for the first Bush, he looked at that World War I precedent and was very careful about how to approach the military security architecture that would result with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Whether he would have expanded NATO later, possibly, but I think he would have done it in a larger context of European security institutions. You know, the other president who, and there are a very poignant photo of the aging Gorbachev and Bush before George Bush's passing. The other president who saw both of those wars was John F. Kennedy, same generation. Kennedy, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and this is in Bobby Kennedy's memoirs, he had just read The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman, showing that unnecessary lurch into World War I. And it was much on Kennedy's mind as he steered his way through this crisis. He had all military officers in the US worldwide get a copy of this book. That's how important he felt it was. You know, we've had boomer presidents now, the last four. It's my generation. I don't think our generation is as aware of this. I think we focus on World War II, on the lessons of not standing up, the lessons of the 30s. In fact, you're hearing that again today as people talk about China and other things, and maybe a deeper view is needed. And of course, it is the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. It was, here are Merkel and Macron in the train car where the armistice was signed. Here are the world leaders who gathered. I would highly recommend a film that's out now, Thou Shalt Not Grow Old. Taking documentary footage from World War I. It's Peter Jackson from Lord of the Rings who has spent years colorizing these images to the point where when you see this film, it's like it's today. It really brings you back into that war. So last two things, you know, we've got to watch our debt. If I leave you with one message from this presentation is that our country right now is veering toward serious debt issues. I sometimes wonder, you know, even if it is a jungle out there, even if it is like the 1930s, as people are saying now, are we really strong and solvent enough and resolved enough to really just determine developments from here? Has the world become more complex, more, if you will, multipolar? Can we really go back to that? I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't, but I'm just saying this is worth discussing. Whether we should quixotically attempt to change governments and cultures by force, because I think above all we need to keep our own country solvent and strong, and that's been a benefit for other countries as a model always. And anyway, I just think that as the debate goes forward, we need to look at this very carefully in terms of where our country is, where public opinion is, as we go forward. And that's the key relationship. Well, I will stop now.